You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Shots in the Dark by Catherine Aban. The export certificate, stamped in Shenzhen on September 25, 2023, appears to be authentic. It identifies the cargo as Ozempic from lot NAR0074, but it lists a product code for leather items, such as handbags, which may have enabled the shipment to slip past customs. When the FDA briefed Congress on its investigation, it said at least some of the counterfeit product had been smuggled illegally into the U.S. through ports of entry, according to a source familiar with the proceedings. Who actually counterfeited the Ozempic pens remains unclear, but the sales date listed on the packaging manifest, August 10, 2023, a few days before Novo Nordisk CEO arrived in China, raises the possibility that the pens, which contained real semaglutide, though not the exact dose, could have been manufactured during the period when Ozempic's patent protection there had been paused. Asked about this possibility, the Novo Nordisk spokesperson said, "We cannot speculate on whether the patent invalidation has had a causal relationship of counterfeit products given the complexity of this case." As Novo Nordisk scrambles to ramp up its worldwide supply of Ozempic and Wegovy, purchasing manufacturing plants to expand production, it is also under pressure to reduce the medication's explosive cost. A recent study found that GLP-1 drugs could be manufactured for less than $5 a month. While a price reduction would help many more patients access the drug, it could have an additional benefit of making the drugs a less attractive target for counterfeiters. The question of how at least 10,000 units of counterfeit Ozempic entered America's drug supply, bearing fake repetitive serial numbers, undetected by authorities, including the FDA, is still being unraveled. But for Dennis Moore at Hudson Scientific, the takeaway is simple. The system failed. That's the key piece. Additional reporting by Beryl Eske and Catherine Lee. Additional research by Stan Friedman. Thank you. The Hitman. Between Anyone But You and the upcoming Twisters, Glenn Powell has seen all kinds of action on the way to becoming one of Hollywood's hottest young stars, by Brett Hennemuth. Photographs by Matthew Brooks. Styled by Sippy Tirabassi. Opening photo shows Glenn Powell at the steering wheel of a pickup truck. All photos taken in March at a ranch in Lancaster, California. When he was 19, Glenn Powell made a bad decision straight out of an 80s teen comedy. He threw a party in somebody else's house in Beverly Hills without asking permission. Denzel Washington had recently cast him as Harvard debater number one in The Great Debaters and told him he had promise. So Powell had left the University of Texas at Austin and moved into a Los Angeles pool house belonging to a college friend's mom. Powell was manning for cash and self-taping auditions. Occasionally, he'd land a guest spot on a CSI or Rizzoli and Isles, thanks to the support of Washington's late agent Ed Limato, who used to say Powell was a cross between William Hurt and Richard Gere. Otherwise, Powell didn't have much going for him, except access to a house in 90210. "I came from that college party mentality where there are no boundaries," he says. "Nobody gives an F about you in Hollywood if you can't offer them something. I made a mistake and offered the house." You've seen enough movies to know what happened next. 75 uninvited strangers flooded the party, the pool, and the main house. Then his friend's younger sister came home. She evicted Powell on the spot, adding in her fury that he'd never make it in Hollywood. "She laid into me that night, and rightfully so," Powell says. "But I've probably been told you'll never make it in this town more than any individual alive. The odds are so slim that people hand that quote out like candy." Powell had to relocate out by the airport in hot, gusty Van Nuys. I was like, "You know what? This is where you deserve to be, you piece of shit." It was like the worst hangover ever. But every major turning point in my time out here has always come from a hit in the face. 15 years later, Powell is reportedly the second most bankable young actor in the business, thanks to Top Gun Maverick and the romantic comedy Anyone But You with Sydney Sweeney, which TikTok turned into a $219 million global smash. This puts him behind only Timothée Chalamet. While Chalamet zigs with bilingual allure and boyish androgyny, Powell zags with all-American brawn, leavening it with goofball energy and southern charisma. This month, he nails a sly, chameleonic turn in Richard Linklater's action comedy Hitman on Netflix. And in July, he will recklessly court danger in Universal's disaster movie Twisters. Powell recently had dinner with executives from the major theater chains. Like his flight instructor Tom Cruise, he's got an old-fashioned conviction about putting bodies in seats, and the chains need him as much as he needs them. "Early one Sunday, Powell picks me up at home in a big old honkin' truck that a studio hooked him up with while he's in L.A. At the height of his career, Powell has actually moved back to Austin to be with family and friends. His parents are on the speakerphone when I get in the truck. They tell me they're just over the moon that their son is based in Texas again, even if he's invariably on some far-flung set anyway. We stop by a flea market to look for furniture for his new place. Powell came here for years, but life is different lately. Even in a ball cap and blue jeans, everyone recognizes him. Before the move back to Austin, an Uber driver had turned into a stalker. A woman who'd never looked his way was now aggressively interested, and friends he'd known forever suddenly had scripts they needed him to read. I literally felt like a commodity for the first time," Powell says. "I started to think this may be a problem." Powell got his first taste of attention overload while shooting Anyone But You in Australia, when paparazzi photos of him and Sweeney on the set were taken out of context to stoke rumors of an affair. It didn't help that Powell had just broken up with his long-term girlfriend. Sweeney's fiancé was a producer on the film and present for the entire shoot. But the tabloids and social media ran with the story they wanted to hear. Powell tries to make sense of it all, even as he is stopped almost comically often by fans for selfies. I went straight from Australia to Oklahoma to film Twisters, and all that social media attention started happening as soon as I landed, he says. When you're in Oklahoma, all that stuff feels louder because you're away from your people. All you're left with is your thoughts. Excuse me, says a young woman, can I get a picture? Powell happily agrees, and when she's moved on, he continues, at the height of the day, I don't give an F anymore. At the time, I did give an F. I gave a lot of Fs, and it felt shitty and personal. I don't think people realize that I am very sensitive because I am a guy that jokes about stuff. The gamification of this gig is that you basically have to. Mr. Powell, says a teenager in a golf shirt. Yeah? Oh my gosh, you're in Maverick, right? Yeah. Can I have a selfie? Yeah, of course. Nice meeting you, man. The boy's mom tells Powell that they're in L.A. for college tours. Where are you touring? Powell asks. We're touring USC tomorrow and UCLA, the boy says. Oh, that's awesome, man, Powell says. Well, good luck at college. You've chosen the right state for it. Then to me, without skipping a beat, it's almost like creating a wrestler alter ego. It's like you're Bruce Wayne and Batman. Nobody has the full picture, so you have to be okay with them not having a full picture. It's entertainment. I'm okay now with my personal life being part of the entertainment. When Anyone But You came out this past Christmas, it initially bombed. But over the holidays, the social media buzz ramped up. Videos of fans singing Natasha Bedingfield's Unwritten, the movie's theme song, as they left theaters became a trend. Plus, the affair rumors resurfaced. So we leaned in, Powell says. In March, he even popped up on Saturday Night Live when Sweeney was hosting to lampoon the speculation. We leaned into the chemistry. We leaned into the fun. We leaned into all of it, and the movie benefited. The fun part with Sid was figuring out what was going to be noisy and sticky. People talk about TikTok as a thing that is cannibalizing the theaters, and what we saw is that they feed into each other. It becomes more eventized and more fun. Glenn, the person, would not have been comfortable with that a year and a half ago. Now I can put myself in a different place and be a character. Audiences have loudly requested an Anyone But You sequel, and ideas are being batted around. As we navigate the flea market, Powell tells me not to let him near anyone selling candles. He's a sucker for them, particularly high-concept ones like Goop's iconic This Smells Like My Vagina and the Saltburn keepsake known as Jacob Elordi's Bathwater. So we steer clear of candles. Instead, Powell buys some David Sedaris books to read on set, and we head off to brunch. The restaurant is filled with women in bandage dresses and high heels, having bachelorette parties and baby showers. Soon iPhones start coyly popping up as people try to capture a movie star in the wild. This is why dating in the era of Dormoir is taxing. The week before we met, Powell left a comedy show and was walking next to someone he'd never even heard of. The internet immediately insisted they were dating. People are creating constellations, he says. You look at the stars and you draw lines and create a picture. In the past, I would have been like, that's not the right constellation, that's not Orion's belt. And now you're sort of like, oh, that's fine, let them connect the dots however they want. Professionally, Powell's life is at a high tide. He's heading to Cape Town to star in a revenge thriller called Huntington for A24. Then there's Edgar Wright's remake of The Running Man for Paramount. Powell will presumably be in the mix for Top Gun 3, which is reportedly in the works, and is set to do a sports comedy series for Hulu, in which he will play Chad Powers, an undercover superstar quarterback that Eli Manning created when he tried out for Penn State in a wig and prosthetics. With all these projects, I ask Powell how he finds time for himself, or for a relationship that isn't a tabloid creation. I don't want to be that guy that wakes up 50 years old and didn't let anybody along for the ride, he says. I don't think it'll ever be me because I look at my parents and I want kids. I really want that. So I don't think that'll happen, but I understand how it could happen. Powell isn't looking to emulate any particular actor's career, though he's grateful to have Cruise and Matthew McConaughey as mentors, and admires the way Matt Damon has handled family and privacy. Until then, he's happy to be living close to his parents, sister, aunts, uncles, and cousins. In May, he'll be presented with an award from the Texas Film Hall of Fame by his fellow Austinite Linklater. I got a plus 45, Powell says. The squad rolls deep. It's going to be a party. This time, at his own house. Magical Thinking. Gabriel Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude, has never been faithfully adapted for the screen, partly because he wouldn't allow it in his lifetime. With a Netflix series now in the works, Vanity Fair tracks the long journey of a masterpiece by Silvana Paternostro. Opening photograph shows a small village with dusty streets and vine-covered buildings with mountains in the background. The opening photo is the fictional Macondo, which was built for the series in the Colombian Andes. One evening in June 1965, a tired Gabriel Garcia Marquez returned to his hotel after a full day as a screenwriter on the set of a film outside of Mexico City. A young couple was waiting to speak with him. Gabo, as he's commonly known in Latin America, was then in his late 30s and had published 4 books, but his masterpiece, 100 Years of Solitude, was a few years away. He had been mulling over the premise for a long time, and his confidence in the novel was unshakable. He had told his younger brother, Gustavo, that he would one day write a book that would be read more than Don Quixote. And after his wedding, he told his wife, Mercedes, not to worry about money, because at 40, he would publish a novel the entire world would know. He did. Now, 57 years after its publication, Netflix is making the first true adaptation of 100 Years of Solitude for a series due later this year. The Garcia Marquez Fund is very healthy, says Pilar Reyes, editorial director of Penguin Random House in Spain. But back in 1965, Gabo was still an impoverished writer, even if well-regarded among Latin American bibliophiles. He was living in Mexico City with his wife and 2 young sons. He was a chain-smoking transplant from the Colombian Caribbean who earned a living writing copy for an advertising agency, which he hated doing, with the occasional screenwriting gig, which he much preferred. As the 2 strangers asking to interview him were about to discover, his ability to tell a captivating tale was already in full force in those drudging days. The couple, a German interpreter named Barbara Doman and the Chilean-born writer Luis Harse, had been commissioned by Harper and Row to interview Latin American writers for a book introducing their work to a stateside audience. Gabo, delighted at the prospect, began to tell them a story. He literally came to our room, lay on our bed, smoked cigarette after cigarette, and just talked. Doman, who went on to a successful career as a British barrister, told me last year in London. Later, when she read his next novel, Doman realized she had listened to Gabo tell the story of 100 Years of Solitude firsthand. A Spanish writer-actor named Maria Luisa Elio remembered being floored by Gabo's loquaciousness too. She and her husband, Omi Garcia Ascot, were part of the large group of exiles after the Spanish Civil War and were introduced to Gabo through writers and filmmakers that he hung out with. We went to lunch, and he told me about a priest who levitated, and I believed him, Elio said in 2001. When I asked why the great novelist had dedicated the novel to her and her husband. After we were left alone and he told me the entire book, I said to him, if you write this, you will be writing the Bible. Next photos, the author in 1980 with his wife, Mercedes, and their sons, Gonzalo and Rodrigo. 2 years later, Gabriel Garcia Marquez would win the Nobel Prize in Literature. The writer at work in 1962, and a first edition of his masterwork. Gabo attempted to tackle 100 Years of Solitude in the early 1950s on rolls of paper he took from the newspaper where he worked as a struggling reporter in Barranquilla, Colombia. He lived in a hotel alongside ladies of the night because the rent was cheap and loved to tell people how the prostitutes let him borrow their soap. When Gabo finally finished writing the story of a tropical town called Macondo that doesn't appear in any map, as Harse called it, he sent the manuscript to the Mexican writer Carlos Fuentes. It was a monstrous tome, or mummum tritto, as Gabo referred to it. When Fuentes read the last page, he wrote to his friend to say that the novel's magnificence had left him crushed. 100 Years was published in June 1967 in Argentina. Legend has it that when its first print run of 10,000 copies sold out in the region in 3 weeks, Gabo asked the publisher to send him his royalties in cash so he and his family could feel more viscerally that what was happening was real. 3 years later, when the book was published in the United States, the New York Times called it a South American genesis. Gabo won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1982. In Latin America, he has since reached godlike status. I came to know Gabo's work because I was born in Barranquilla, the port city where he worked as a reporter. And my childhood was imbued with the same exuberant spirit and storytelling that powered his work. I met him in 1995 when I was a freelance journalist in New York and applied to a writing workshop he was giving in Cartagena. It was 3 unforgettable days during which he advised us that our goal as storytellers was to grip readers entirely. Writing is a hypnotic act. I noticed how much Gabo liked to name drop. Fidel Castro had once eaten 18 scoops of ice cream in front of him, but I was most struck by how much he reminded me of my own family. I was in awe of the way he had turned the humdrum daily experiences of Caribbean life into a literary kingdom with universal heft. Did Gabo manage to write Latin America's Don Quixote? It is a groundbreaking work of art, says Jean Belviada, co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, to which his editing partner, Ignacio López Calvo, adds, "This book is actually the embodiment of world literature." Circulating worldwide, being translated in so many languages, and being appreciated and imitated by so many readers and writers throughout the world, it still has hold. Last fall, Dua Lipa posted a photo of herself holding the novel. "It's irresistible," she wrote. Before 100 years, few had heard the term magical realism. Now it's routinely used to evoke the literature of a whole continent. Gabo's formula, which took about 17 years to cook, mixed Kafka's The Metamorphosis, Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, and the Spanish Chronicles of the Indies with Faulkner and Hemingway. He overlaid the techniques of his literary masters onto stories that he collected firsthand, especially from the first 8 years of his life, when he lived with his grandparents in Aracataca, a backward town that had experienced the wars, booms, and bust that he went on to describe in his imaginary Macondo. Latin American writers have lived with the shadow of Garcia Marquez and of magical realism ever since. Writers like Isabel Allende and Laura Esquivel were greatly influenced by him. Others, like Chilean writer Alberto Fouqué and the Mexican writer Jorge Volpi, overtly rejected his influence and defied admonitions that if their novels didn't feature flying grandmothers, they had no chance of being published in the United States. The label has proven impossible to dodge. "I write realism," the novelist Guadalupe Nettel tells me on the phone from Mexico City. One of her short stories is about a family that eats insects to reverse a curse. So reviewers refer to her work as magical realism. "But I write it as realism," she says. "In Mexico, we have these customs." Still, in the U.S., they call magical realism whatever they can't label. Next, photos. Behind the scenes of the Netflix series. Young Jose Arcadio Buendia, played by Marco Antonio Gonzalez, and young Ursula Iharan, Susana Morales, search for land where they can build the town that will be Macondo. Garcia Marquez's near-mythical ascent from a nobody born in a remote Colombian town to the world's most widely read Spanish-language writer is filled with all kinds of lore. Some of the myth-making was instigated by Gabo himself. He had a mischievous desire to inflate his own story as if it were one of his fictions. As he wrote in a wry note to Fuentes, "I was no savior when it came to Mexican film, but I do believe I can be of much help in our efforts to bring Latin American novels to the world." With its lavish 2-part, 16-episode adaptation, Netflix hopes to introduce new audiences to the saga of the 7 generations of the doomed Buendia family and their eccentric, wild, passionate, corrupt, innocent, voluble, incestuous, beautiful, sad, and often mad lives in Macondo. It's a momentous and risky endeavor. I asked Francisco Ramos, Netflix's vice president of Latin American content and godfather of the project, if 100 Years will be a tropical version of 2 other hit series centered around families, Game of Thrones and The Crown. Well, he tells me via video call from Mexico City without missing a beat, the Buendias are certainly more fun than the Windsors. The raw material is all there. As Garcia Marquez knew so well, the hard part lies in the execution. Gabo always loved film. His eldest son, Rodrigo Garcia Barcha, himself a writer-director of films, recalls his father's love for Akira Kurosawa's Red Beard, Truffaut's Jules et Jim, and Alain René's Providence, to name a few. He also loved Sam Peckinpah and had a soft spot for the Italian neorealist. Garcia Barca remembers that when he was in his early teens, his parents took him to see Last Tango in Paris and the story of Adele H. By the 70s, after Gabo had become relatively wealthy, he spent a lot of time and money on the moving image. He was involved in TV production in Colombia, wrote scripts, and helped set up a film school in Cuba, where he gave screenwriting workshops. Fernando Restrepo, his partner in the Colombian venture, once told me that Gabo tried to set up a film production company that he planned to call Solitude and Company, which I later borrowed for the title of an oral history I wrote about his life. Two of his most beloved works, Chronicle of a Death Foretold and Love in the Time of Cholera, have been turned into movies, but neither did the novels justice. The former, directed by Francesco Rossi, played like a misguided Italian operetta. The latter, directed by Mike Newell, was cartoonish and over-dramatized, and starred non-Colombian actors who spoke in English in the lead roles. Truly awful, Lopez Calvo says by email of many of the adaptations. Adding that he thinks the small screen will suit the novel well. A TV series seems ideal today for such a complex and sophisticated work, and television series have changed dramatically in recent years. Perhaps Gabo would have been okay with it today. Who knows? Lopez Calvo is referring to the fact that Gabo never wanted his most famous book to be made into a film, preferring readers to imagine the characters for themselves. He said it would take 100 hours to tell the story properly, and that the only way he could even begin to conceive of an acceptable adaptation was if it were in Spanish and shot in Colombia. But in truth, Gabo said many things, and often they were purposefully contradictory. He loved hanging out with Hollywood stars. He visited Robert Redford at the Sundance Institute, and Francis Ford Coppola once cooked pasta at his house in Havana. Even as he declined to sell the rights to his masterwork to luminaries including William Friedkin, Werner Herzog, and Dino De Laurentiis. There is, however, an obscure Japanese adaptation from 1981. Shortly after Gabo's death in 2014, I ask his agent, the legendary Carmen Balcells, if there would ever be a true and full adaptation of the novel. Her answer was absolute. He never wanted a film made of 100 years, And even today, it's a desire respected by his family, which I think will be upheld forever. His children have a different recollection of their father's wishes. He was always a little tempted to make the books into movies, says Garcia Barta, but he said no so many times that the offers disappeared. Gabo's widow, Mercedes, died in 2020, so now all decisions are in the hands of Garcia Barca and his brother Gonzalo. Gabo said to us that once he was dead, we could do whatever we wanted, Garcia Barca says. Just don't bother me. Such a proclamation sounds to me like the lapidary phrases that Gabo would give to one of his characters. The author's son follows up with one of his own. It is the living that have to make decisions. The brothers have been criticized in some quarters for allowing the Netflix adaptation and for the recent publication of Until August, an unfinished novel that Gabo, already suffering from advanced dementia, had ordered to be destroyed. The book has had mixed reviews, mostly glowing and respectful in Colombia, terrible in the United States. When I read that we are being greedy, I feel sad for a few minutes, but ultimately these are the decisions we have to make, says Garcia Barca. In 2018, Ramos, who had just been appointed to his new post at Netflix, was ready to take the streamer's Latin American offerings to another level. Netflix's philosophy of going local had already proven effective worldwide. The Crown is British. Squid Game is South Korean. Money Heist is Spanish. The House of Flowers is Mexican. It was time to replicate this formula in South American countries. Narcos takes place in Colombia and Mexico, but it's a Netflix U.S. production. The idea of adapting 100 Years started to float around in corporate meetings, and it stuck. Ramos ran with it, but first he had to negotiate with Mercedes, who was still part of the estate's decision-making at the time. Gabo's family demanded that the series be as long as the story required, that it be in Spanish, and that it be filmed in Colombia. Gabo's sons came on board as executive producers. Next photos, It Takes a Village. Jose Arcadio Buendia and Ursula Igarán's nuptials. And fur traffickers cross the desert on their way to Macondo. Macondo was built near Ibagué, a town in the Andes. It's far from the Caribbean, but it has a similar mountainous topography to the area around Aracataca, where the foothills of the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta cascade into the sea. Eugenio Caballero, Pan's Labyrinth, and Barbara Enriquez, Roma, have designed the sets, so Macondo in the Andes promises to be gorgeous. On set, as in the novel, Macondo transforms from a settlement of straw-roofed huts for 20 families into a full-blown town. It's all been built in human scale. You can walk around the Buendia house, the pharmacy, the bar, and the market. Some of Gabo's most ardent fans will be wary of seeing characters that have lived in their imaginations for the last 6 decades. I don't want Netflix to tell me what Colonel Arellano Buendia looks like, says Colombian-born Gustavo Arango, a professor of literature and author of 2 books about Garcia Marquez. I've always imagined he looks like my grandfather, as every Colombian has. But when I'm shown some early footage in Bogotá, I enjoy seeing those faces in locations that to me seem out of a biblical Colombia. I recognize the arrival of Melquiades, the gypsy who disturbs the idyllic hamlet when he appears with his impressive magnet and his magnifying glass, and the advent of Rebecca, the child that eats earth with her hands. I enjoy the anger with which the Buendia patriarch receives the government official who comes to his front door, thinking he can tell the people of Macondo what to do. The costumes are elaborate, every detail perfectly curated. The actors all have amazing faces. There are no stars in the production, although many are respected local actors, including Claudio Cattaneo as Colonel Arellano Buendia, Marleida Soto as the older Ursula Igarán, and Diego Vasquez as the older Jose Arcadio Buendía. The non-actors prepared by attending theater workshops. Like the novel, the 100-year series is sparing with dialogue. It's certainly not Succession, says Alex Garcia Lopez, the principal director, on a video call from Barcelona. Some of the one-liners I hear are memorable, however. When Ursula Iharán gives birth to her first child, he is born with women's buttocks. Garcia Lopez also tells me that the series won't be like the phantasmagorical Harry Potter. When a ghost shows up and there's a halo and the music goes up, that answers the magical realism question. Netflix isn't interested in flashy and expensive special effects. The directing is split between two Latin Americans. Garcia Lopez was born in Argentina and has ample experience working on big American productions, including a few Marvel series. The other director is Colombian-born writer-director Lara Mora, who has a long-standing relationship with Netflix, and whose films, The Kings of the World and Killing Jesus, have earned festival acclaim. The director's styles couldn't be more different. Garcia Lopez is vertiginous. I wanted a lot of movement. I wanted to capture the chaos. Where Mora is contemplative, I'm a cinema purist. Garcia Lopez shoots from above, Mora from a more intimate perspective. Garcia Lopez mentions Kusturica and Terrence Malick. Mora references Fellini and Lucretia Martel. I think they chose us because we are so different, says Mora on a video call from her native Medellin, and because we are a good complement. They also reflect the two different histories within the novel. 100 years offers a metaphorical history of civilization in the largest sense, as well as the more specific story of Colombia and the Caribbean. The book never actually mentions dates, and it plays with time. This adaptation, conceived by Jose Rivera, the Oscar-nominated screenwriter of The Motorcycle Diaries, is linear and closely pegged to what happened in Colombia between 1850 and 1950. Garcia Lopez, perhaps because he is not Colombian, sees the universal message about the failure of societies. Mora highlights the tragedy of Colombia and the country's inability to find a way to live together after a century of violence. Both directors are quick to point out that their adaptation will be as demanding as the novel. It is not light entertainment, says Mora, who compares it to the tone and scope of Killers of the Flower Moon. It deals with big, strong themes, a complex universe. Filming the series, particularly in Colombia, has meant doing justice to a work of art held up as a symbol of patriotic pride. Vasquez, who plays the older Jose Arcadio Buendía, gets so moved at times that he cries on set. He can't believe that life has given him the opportunity to play such an emblematic character, even though he spends much of his time tied to a tree. During production in Colombia, Garcia Lopez says he continually heard, "This is so important to us. This story is so Colombian." I would go, "Yes, but once a book sells 50 million copies worldwide, it becomes a global phenomenon. It doesn't belong to you anymore. It belongs to humanity." It is 4 p.m, and the Caribbean sun is easing when I meet Gabriel Anillo Torres Garcia, Gabo's nephew, in the Parque de Bolívar, one of Colonial Cartagena's main squares. Gabo Gabo, as he is known, gives walking tours of the spots where his uncle used to hang out. He integrates both fictional characters and real places that Gabo mentions in his novels, especially love in the time of cholera, which is mostly set in a city inspired by this walled port. Gabo Gabo, a nickname given to him by his famous uncle to distinguish him from the other three Gabriels in his family, greets me with typical Caribbean warmth, as if we have known each other all our lives. He points to the park bench where he was sitting and tells me Gabo spent his first night in Cartagena right there. It was 1948. He had dropped out of law school in Bogota, deciding that he would rebel against his parents' expectations and dedicate his life to writing. He didn't go home to where his parents lived because he knew his mother would be able to figure it out just by looking at him. He lied and said he would enroll in Cartagena's law school and convinced a relative to bring him the money he needed for a room. In the meantime, Gabo Gabo says, he would wait and sleep here until two cops came by, smoked all his cigarettes, and took him to the police precinct. Thanks to a recommendation from a friend, Gabo was hired to write editorials at El Universal. My guide tells me, as we pass the dilapidated building that used to house the newspaper. At 21, Gabo walked through the arches known as the Clock Tower and realized that Cartagena would become his home in the Caribbean. Gabo Gabo quotes his uncle's memoir, Living to Tell the Tale. I could not repress the feeling of having been born again. In his late 60s, Gabo bought an old yarn factory that faced the sea and hired Rogelio Salmona, Colombia's premier architect, to build his red-bricked palazzo. It was where he came to smell the guavas, the metaphor he used for his yearning for the tropics. Cartagena and its colonial history and architecture, the fortress that kept the pirates at bay, is as storied and beautiful as the Caribbean gets. It was also the place where his parents and most of his siblings had ended up and would religiously gather for New Year's. Gabo loved walking the streets and getting recognized if he needed a bath of fame, which he sometimes did. Gabo Gabo sprinkles his stories with indiscreet family details. He tells me that he inherited the role of teller of family lore after his uncle Aime, Gabo's brother, succumbed to dementia. We live with the blessing of our storytelling ability and with the curse of memory loss, Gabo Gabo says. My uncle wrote about the plague of forgetfulness in 100 years of solitude, and here we are, 50 years later, a premonition come true. Gabo Gabo's own mother Rita's illness is so advanced that she doesn't recognize her son. The sunset hour is approaching as we walk toward Gabo's house. It is clear from Gabo Gabo's stories how much Gabo drew his stories and characters from real-life incidents and people. Gabo Gabo's sister Margot not only ate earth like Rebecca, but was as spiteful as Amaranta, both characters in 100 years. The character of Candida Arendira, the poor girl who was paraded and prostituted by her grandmother across the desert, in the short story that bears her name, is based on a housemaid that serviced all his uncles, including Gabo. I blanch at some of these intimate details. Did Gabo oppose the telling of such indiscretions? I ask. According to Gabo Gabo, the great writer's advice was quite direct. Just make sure you charge money for them. The family skill at storytelling, Gabo Gabo tells me, stemmed from a long-standing tradition during which everybody would sit around and tell and retell the history of their immediate family and its ancestors. I can identify each one of my aunts and uncles in 100 years of solitude, he says. His grandmother was unimpressed by how Gabo, who usually only listened during those storytelling sessions, recycled real-life family tales in his fiction. She always said that she preferred her daughter Aida Rosa, who was a nun, to her son, who was a Nobel Prize winner. Gabo Gabo points at a white balconied colonial mansion. That was the inspiration for Fermina Daza's house in Love in the Time of Cholera, he says. He asked me if I remember how her husband, Dr. Urbino, died. Yes, he fell from a ladder trying to grab a parrot, I say. That is exactly how Gabo's grandfather died, he tells me. So my uncle took that detail, something that happened when he was 8 years old, and pum, he grabbed it when he needed it. After the tour, we stop by to see Aime Abello, who runs the Gabo Foundation, an organization that Garcia Marquez started in 1995 to promote independent journalism, and that has become an important guardian of Gabo's legacy. We find Abeo sitting at his desk, a portrait of Gabo behind him. He is excited to show us his latest project, a 650-page book written by Juan Valentin Fernandez, a Spanish doctor who spent a decade tracing all the medical details and real-life doctors that Garcia Marquez mentioned in his fiction. "Look at how exhaustive Gabo was," Abeo says, showing me the manuscript. "Everything, everything is based in reality." He turns to Gabo. "Gabo, do you remember the questionnaires? Garcia Marquez's closest siblings, friends, and associates would receive pages of questions. Abeo got one when Gabo was working on the section in his memoirs about his time in Barranquilla. He not only wanted to know the name of the brothels, he wanted to know the size of the rooms." Abeo then grabs another book published by the foundation titled Gabo, Journalist, a chronology of his life as a reporter and a collection of his quotes about the profession. He opens the book and asks me to read one. "My books are a journalist books, even if not many people see them as such. But these books involve a ton of research, checking of data, historical strictness, and dedication to the facts, which in essence makes them fictionalized or fantasized works of reportage. The methods of research and handling of data are those of a journalist." Abeo closes the book with determination. The real magic is Gabo's writing. The posthumous publication of Gabo's last novel, combined with the promise of the Netflix series, has sparked Gabo mania in Colombia. Everyone who is anyone has written a newspaper column, recorded a podcast, or posted a photograph taken with a great man on social media. The government has organized a Macondo route, hoping that just as the fans of Game of Thrones visit Croatia to see where the series was filmed, fans of Gabo's writing will come to Colombia to see the locations from 100 years. In Barranquilla, Gabo readers can now stay in room 204 of a present-day hotel that claims it was the boarding house where he once wrote and borrowed soap. The Colombian writer Carolina Sanin takes issue with all this off-the-cuff storytelling that takes over her country. She even refuses to call the novelist Gabo. "He deserves better than the picturesque approach," she insists. "Garcia Marquez wrote an epic about the birth and rebirth of civilization, written from the other side of the world. He is Latin America's Homer," she tells me as we sit in a coffee shop in Bogota, where she grew up. "He was fully aware of the magnitude of that book. It was an illumination that defined the difference between the old world and the new world, and why we are different." When Until August came out in March, its selling point was that the protagonist was a modern woman who dared to explore her sexuality outside of her marriage. I find it endearing to see Garcia Marquez taking this risk. It speaks of his resilience and discipline that got him to finish his novels, against all odds in his 20s and against all odds in his 80s, with a Damocles sword of dementia dangling over him. But a younger generation of women bristles at the marketing of the novella. "Honestly," says Nadia Celis, a Colombian-born writer and professor at Bowdoin College, who specializes in feminist readings of the Caribbean, "women readers today don't need someone akin to a grandfather dictating our path to freedom, sexual or otherwise." Celis can also be critical of her literary hero. "That I criticize his portrayal of the women does not mean I don't admire the author or that I dismiss the importance of his work," she says. In 100 years, Remedios Moscote is 9 years old when she is spotted by her Buendia suitor, is married right after her first menstruation, and dies right before giving birth to twins. In Love in the Time of Cholera, Florentino Azzisa takes a 12-year-old girl as his lover while he waits for Fermina, the love of his life, to give in to him. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.